Welcome back, or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, I'm joined by Simon Freeman from Like the Wind magazine. We talk about differences in running culture across the globe, the nuts and bolts of building and maintaining a media brand in the sport, and conclude the episode with some of his insights into the professional scene in Iten, Kenya. Simon Freeman, it is a pleasure to have you on the Single Track Podcast. How are you doing today?
Very well indeed, thank you. In the Pacific Northwest, which is not my home territory, but enjoying the Pacific Northwest weather.
What are the initial impressions? Have you been there before?
I have, strangely. So I'm just turned 49 years old, pretty ancient, basically. And my best friend and I at university, we decided to come to the US straight after graduation. We flew to Vancouver. We were like 21 years old. Flew to Vancouver, spent as much time as we could in Whistler before we started running out of money, and then headed south, essentially. And we did a massive loop, big U-shape, and ended up in New York. We were traveling for about nearly 3 months, I think. Maybe more, 4 months. And so we've hit all these spots So the reason I'm in the Pacific Northwest is that my wife, who's the co-founder of Like the Wind, and I are coming to the US to sort of try and raise the profile of Like the Wind magazine. And we've got a tour starting here in Seattle, and then we've got loads of dates all around the US. And we're sort of following in the footsteps of me and my buddy from 30 years ago. Literally in Seattle, on the day that we arrived, we walked past a bar and I looked up and I thought, wow, I've got mad deja vu. And it was a bar that my buddy and I found ourselves in when we were 21. So yeah, I have been here before. I'm now here with probably a little less 20-year-old naivety. So it's a different experience.
You just made me think of this because obviously your magazine deals with pretty universal topics in the space. It has sort of global relevance, and you've done a fair bit of traveling. Have you found that running culture is pretty universal? Like what you see in Japan is what you would see in Seattle, or can you tell the differences at this point based on the regions?
That is a brilliant question. And my answer now is I think running culture is distinct everywhere in the world, from my experience, but running isn't. And so there's this sort of, the only way that I can describe it is if the entire world spoke one language, it's like we all speak the same language, but we all have different accents, if you see what I mean. So, and this really hit home. So you mentioned Japan. We launched a Japanese version of Like the Wind last year with a colleague, Kyo Fujishiro, who is based in Tokyo. And we went out, Julie and I went out for the launch of Like the Wind Japan issue one. And I actually flew back from Japan, spent 3 days at home in Switzerland where I live, just basically changed bags, and then flew to New York for the marathon last year. And so in a very short space of time, I had these very interesting kind of running experiences. And I thought, Japanese running culture is distinctly different from European, Swiss, or let's say European running culture, which is distinctly different from New York running culture, which I imagine is probably distinctly different from, I don't know, Boulder running culture. Obviously, the thing you're doing is the same, pretty much. I mean, running's running. But people's approach seems to be wildly different. So, which is wonderful. I mean, that's what makes the world go round. But it sort of made me think about Like the Wind and the stories we tell almost a bit more like a travelogue, like we're bringing running culture to a global audience from all these different places, and how somebody would write about running who's from, you know, Salt Lake City or Boulder. Somebody in London, oh, crumbs. I didn't mean to do that.
The fireworks went off.
No way. Okay. We'll just keep going, pretend that didn't happen.
Riverside has these things where, like, if you make certain hand motions, like balloons pop up. It's, yeah, don't worry about
I'll
it.
I'll sit on my hands. you know, so somebody reading the magazine in London would be learning about the Pacific Northwest or Japan or Australia or, you know, Boulder. It's not a travel log. but it's like we're bringing those different ideas of culture from different places. And then there's a third dimension, which is obviously running culture is different amongst different types of people, you know. The next edition of the magazine, which comes out in June, is our first ever women's issue. So I'm not the editor, which is great. We got a lady, a new female editor working with our existing deputy editor, Imogen, and, you know, all female writers, all female designers, all female illustrators, all female photographers. So we're saying that it's, you know, by women, about women, for everyone. And as a man sat listening to editorial meetings and not really contributing, it's like listening to running from a completely different country. Like I'm like, wow, I didn't know any of this stuff. It's amazing. It's like this sort of exploration, which is really interesting, very, very exciting.
I don't have a good answer for you right now, but maybe a good thought exercise for the audience, because most of us here that listen are probably American-based, reflecting on, for example, the distinguishing factors of the running culture in Salt Lake City versus even just neighboring Boulder, Colorado, or where you're based in Seattle, Washington. Like I haven't really thought of it critically. I feel like at like a subconscious level, I would know the differences when I saw them, but I couldn't vocalize them right now. But I think it's an interesting exercise. And I feel like, especially with all of the conflicts that are going on in our sport right now, you can find a lot of answers to why decisions are made, why people act the way they do, purely based on those regional differences.
For sure. And I think the interesting thing about the US is there is actually this common language, as in everyone speaks English. If I said to you, oh, you know, trail running culture in France is sort of somehow different from trail running culture in Spain, that probably wouldn't come across as such a massive surprise, because you're like, well, they're two different countries, different languages, different histories. Like they're just different places. So that wouldn't be as surprising as to say running culture in Salt Lake City is distinct from running culture in Boulder, because especially from an outsider's perspective, and this is one of the things we're learning, is the US is not a homogenous whole. I mean, it's bigger than Europe, right? So why would there not be distinct differences? But it's a lovely idea for me, as somebody obsessed with storytelling, that we're talking about essentially the same thing. So if you met up with a buddy who lives in Boulder, you're in Salt Lake City, and you went for a run together, it's not like you'd be doing something different. You'd both be having the same experience. You'd both be like, oh, this is super cool. But yeah, those sort of slight accents, I think, is the only way that I can describe it. The accents are different. You're like, oh, okay, cool. This is how you do it here. Interesting.
In a few days, I will be lining up for the Desert Rats 100K in Grand Junction, Colorado. And one of the final pieces to my preparation will be using NAC's nutrition quiz to dial in my fuel intake for the effort. You can do this for a lot of races, actually. Just head over to their website, NAC.com, select your race, input your athlete profile, your ambitions, and a few other data points, and it's going to return exactly how much of their product you should be intaking at key checkpoints along the course to be locked in and on track to hit your finish goals. Personally, I'm going with a primarily liquid calorie-based strategy at Desert Rats, relying on NAC's Ultra Energy Watermelon Drink Mix to get me through. If you're curious about their quiz, I encourage you to go check it out. And if you end up grabbing some product in the process, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout for 15% off your next order. With that, let's get back to the conversation with Simon Freeman. I got a couple background questions for you. Mm. The first, for listeners and viewers that aren't in the know yet, and this is multifaceted, what is Huck? What do they do well? And how did they influence the genesis of Like the Wind?
Oh, so Huck is essentially a skateboarding magazine that doesn't really talk about skateboarding. It talks about punk mindset, music. You know, they have this thing, like a theme. They've produced a book. It's called Paddle Against the Flow. It's like this whole idea of everything is about being distinct and different. And skateboarding, but really what they're dealing with is social issues and things like that. And so as somebody who, when I was sort of in my teen years, wanted to be a skateboarder desperately, but had no coordination and was scared of hurting myself. I was just really bad at it. So I never really got into skateboarding. But later in life, when I became obsessed with magazines, I would buy Huck, not really understanding what they were talking about, and certainly not being part of that culture, but just loving the idea that someone was publishing a magazine that was about life through the lens of something like skateboarding. And so, you know, when Julie and I, and there's many other typical, you know, other titles that are of a similar ilk that, you know, I think address social issues through the lens of an activity, whether that's climbing or surfing or adventure or whatever it is. And that was really what we wanted to do with Like the Wind, was, well, can we sort of be the Huck of running, you know, looking at dealing with social issues through the lens of running, or exploring, yeah, history and culture, but not talking about the mechanics. So you never open a, there's nothing in Huck that tells you how to skate or where to skate or what to skate on. But there'll be loads of stuff about, you know, people. I think people create culture. So profiles on skaters, musicians, artists who happen to be skaters. So yeah, I love Huck. Brilliant.
It's interesting to me because you hear a lot of reporters at, you know, the quote unquote, excuse me, major media outlets in our sport. And they'll say that all of the incentives are for them to work on performance-based content, transactional-based content, maybe reporting on events, but this whole murky area of, you know, interpreting sort of the philosophy of the sport and trying to connect it to the larger dots in life, that content feels so good to create and it's what they want to gravitate to, but all of the metrics say that they don't have the audience there. But you've created this magazine where it's clearly become a sustainable thing. It's gained a lot of traction. Why do you think it's worked for you, but so many other people in the space lament the fact that it's impractical?
I will give you, I'll give you two answers, if I may. One is a bit trite and the other is a bit more serious. So the first answer is the reason it's worked for us is that we've been publishing the magazine for 10 years. We've just literally, early March, mid-March, we published issue 40. So four a year for 10 years of Like the Wind magazine. And for the longest time, we didn't pay ourselves. When I say we, that's Julie and I as the founders. And for quite a long time, for the first probably 3 or 4 years, we didn't pay most of our contributors either. Not because we didn't want to, we just couldn't. We just did. There just wasn't any money. I mean, once we'd sort of, you know, paid the actual fixed overheads, you know, the print, the distribution, the storage, the mailing, the sort of software, the website, and that, there was nothing left. You know, we had lots of people who would volunteer their stories, and the magazine wouldn't exist without them. And, you know, we caught a bit of flack, honestly, from some people who were like, oh, you know, these people just want to, you know, they don't want to pay for people's art. And it wasn't that we didn't want to, we just couldn't. It just wasn't an option. By the way, I'm throwing no shade at any running magazines at all, or any publishers. But when you have a business with offices in the center of New York, or your offices are in the center of London, and you know you've got 25 people on staff, it's impossible to be indulgent and say, well, we're just not going to kowtow to this kind of way of doing things. We're just going to do it our way, which is completely different, and we don't care. Julie and I had that option to say, well, it's fine. We're not going to do it the way that brands or people expect us to do it. We're just going to do it the way we want to do it. And now we're in the fortunate position 10 years on where everyone's like, oh, actually, this is pretty cool. Like we do have brands that support us, and we're incredibly grateful to them because it's allowing us to do what we want to do, which is grow the magazine, you know, reach more readers, pay most of our contributors, be as generous as we can with that sort of stuff. So the trite answer is the way that you do it is to spend the first 8 years just making no money. The slightly more serious answer is what I kind of went on to say, which is I think that the media, the magazine publishing model doesn't really work anymore. And I think the reason it doesn't work is because of, you know, Facebook and Google and, you know, the advertising money has shifted. And, you know, if your title is dependent on advertising revenue because you've got fancy central London offices and 25, 30, 40, I don't know, people on staff, it's incredibly hard to switch the model. We started with a model that was not advertising dependent. The first 5 issues of the magazine, we had no advertising at all on purpose, because what we wanted to do was create the magazine we wanted to create with no pressure. So that when we then started talking to brands, we were like, okay, so this is what we've done for the last year and a half. We'd love you to be involved, but it's on this basis, not on the basis that you're used to or on the basis that you think you want to be involved. This is our model. We'd love you to be involved, but if you're not, if it doesn't work for you, that's fine, but we're not changing our product to suit what you think it should be or what you've been used to, you know? So, you know, and you can't, for example, our magazine's expensive. Like it's a subscription is £40. I think it's about $48, $45 a year for 4 issues. I don't think people who pay $45 a year for 4 issues should have to wade through pages and pages and pages of ads. I'm not trying to do that. I'm not trying to sell ad space based on, you know, circulation, which is copies put out into the world that no one necessarily sees. I'm like, let's just only have subscribers. The numbers are not huge, but I know that every issue is put in an envelope and sent to a person, you know, different model.
I think what you said there about the sort of the 8 years that it took to kind of gain at least like financial traction, that really resonates with me. And I think there is something to be said about a commitment to a content identity. Like I'm just thinking of myself as a consumer. And when I get into that seat and I think about the switching costs for myself to give something like The Wind a shot or any media outlet, it takes a long time. Like I'm a pretty late adopter to most media. It's so hard for me to add like a new podcast, for example, to my rotation. I have to like hear about it like 8 to 12 times. And those 8 to 12, impressions on me can sometimes take years. So for sure. I think like it's a daunting thing, but I think it also makes sense. And I think if most companies are saying we're going to try this for 6 months or a year, that's 12% of what's required, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I also think that, again, remember now when you and I are having this conversation now, Julie and I are running Like the Wind as our business, as our full-time thing. It wasn't for the first 9 years. It was a weekends and evenings project. You know, we had another business that we ran together, and that was what we were trying to build, and that was what paid the bills. So the magazine was like what we would get up on a Sunday morning and be like, cool, we get to spend the day on the magazine now. But there was no commercial pressure. I mean, as in, we kind of wanted the thing to wash its face, but in truth, there were several, many, many times in the first 8 or 9 years where we just paid out of our own bank account to like keep the thing going, because the mission was trying to create a magazine that was a sort of long form storytelling, coffee table, in depth running culture title, not make 50 grand a month or whatever. That wasn't the mission. Whereas I think if you're a publisher, I was about to say a professional publisher, if you're not total amateurs like me and Julie, the reason you're publishing is to make money because you're a business. We weren't trying to do that. Now we are, but we weren't when we started. So I've spoken to many people when we launched the magazine, many people who said, oh, you know, I had that idea. I always had that idea of doing what you guys are doing. I just needed, you know, 50 grand to get started. I was like, oh, we'd saved up some money to renovate our kitchen, and we phoned a printer and said, how many copies can we have for this amount of money? And they said 1,000. We went, all right, fine, we'll print 1,000. I mean, just amateur hour. It's just ridiculous. But, you know, it wasn't... And I'm sure that's frustrating to people. But I think about it a little bit more like there's book authors who are just producing books in order to, you know, make a living. And then I think there are authors who are expressing their art, their craft, their passion. And if the book blows up, great. And if it doesn't, it doesn't, kind of thing. And it's just a different approach, right? It's just a different way of doing essentially the same thing.
I've heard you say that, and the reason I bring this up is because I think we're talking about sort of the pressures that drive a lot of people in the media away from working on more think pieces and evergreen type content. But I've heard you say that the running media often shies away from talking about the current culture and that they dig into the past instead. And I'm curious about that. Like, what do you see as the benefits of sort of being more present-minded and observational about what's happening right this moment?
Again, it comes probably has a link somewhat to kind of commercial considerations, is that if you do what we do, which is you talk about issues like gender inequality, racism, LGBTQI issues, sustainability, you know, we've just published a piece in the current issue, you know, like a 14-page feature that I wrote about gender-based violence and the impact of gender-based violence on female athletes in East Africa. I can understand why a publisher would think, A, that's not super attractive to the brands that are paying the bills. I can imagine why people would think, oh, you know, that's sort of not a fantastically, you know, upbeat topic. And if you think, well, actually the brands are supporting us because they want to sell more shoes, that piece that I wrote for 14 pages 100% does not sell more shoes. But, you know, we're in a fortunate position where we only work with a small number of brands every year as sort of supporters, partners, if you like, and they know what's coming. So I don't have to worry that I might publish. I mean, obviously I'm not about to publish a piece that sort of starts laying into the industry so that our sponsors, our partners sort of think, well, that's a bit rough. But we do address issues like sustainability. We talk about that. We talk about gender inequality. You know, the women's issue that we're about to publish, we're not shying away from the fact that brands have not covered themselves in glory when it comes to gender equality. We're going to publish about that. And you know, frankly, as a reader-supported title, if a brand said to me, oh, that we're really unhappy about that as a topic, I'd be like, okay, no problem. We'll be all right. It's okay. So, which is not to say I don't value the support that the brands give us. It's massively important to us, but it's just not going to dictate the agenda. And the other issue, which again, we are navigating from a position of not being experienced publishers, like we are making it up as we go, is history's fixed, right? Unless you make a factual error when you're talking about history, no one's going to say, well, I'm outraged by the fact that you've published a story about Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile on Iffley Road track in 1954, because it's just a fact. It's just what happened, right? Whereas if you're trying to publish a story about a current social issue through the lens of running, people will have opinions about something that's still in flux and still in flow. So from a publishing perspective, it's a bit scary. Like, as the editor, I'm scared of some of the stories that we publish because I think, oh God, you know, people might come at me after about this because we're expressing an opinion, essentially. There's two sides to every story until the story is in history, and then it's fact and people can't argue with it. You know, they can't say that's wrong because it's proven and it's established. So when we do write about things that happened in the past, because I think history informs current culture, it's somehow a bit more relaxing because I can fact check it and go, that happened. There's 5 sources that agree that that happened. And no one's going to phone me up and tell me that, you know, so-and-so didn't break the record or wasn't the first person to run Western States, or wasn't the whatever, you know, it's done, it's in fact. So the current cultural stuff, I think, is, I was about to say more important, is important, but from a publisher's perspective, it's a bit scarier.
Generally, do you have a point of view about running that you want the magazine to express? Like, are you constantly campaigning in a particular direction? Like, do you want people to think about the sport in a certain way, or is this more a recent development? Like, talk more about that.
So it's more recent in the sense that when we started, we just wanted to tell stories about running, and it was a little more haphazard, and probably subconsciously we kind of knew why we wanted to publish the stories, but it wasn't really expressed. It wasn't really clearly expressed. There are a few things that we're trying to do, one of which is that we believe that everybody should have the right and the opportunity to go for a run. And when we come across stories of people who don't have the same right and opportunity to go for a run as, let's be blunt, me, a middle-class, middle-aged white man, that infuriates the shit out of me. That's what gets me, like, I want to campaign against that. That drives me absolutely nuts. You know, and I can give you one example of that where, and I'm not at all ashamed to say this, where I literally sat on a call in floods of tears. I couldn't stop myself. When Ahmed Arbery was murdered whilst out on a run, I contacted friends of mine from the running world, black men, and because I wanted to try and understand more about the background behind that situation. And one of them, who I consider to just be my absolute contemporary, same age as me, born in London, same education, you know, just he and I are just this, we're just the same people essentially. He's black. He said to me, he kind of said it in such a kind of throwaway sort of, he said, well, I don't go running in the dark. And I was like, what do you mean? We live in London. Like, in the winter, it's dark by 4 o'clock. So what do you mean? He goes, well, you know, black men running down the street in the dark attracts... And I was like, I couldn't stop. I got so upset. This is one of my best friends. I've known him for a decade. I was like, what are you talking about? He was like, no. Well, obviously. I was like, what do you mean, obviously? That's outrageous. That was the tip of the iceberg. I mean, and that goes on and on and on and on. You know, small things like, you know, when the clocks change. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, a woman, and she was like, yeah, I hate it when the clocks change. And I was like, yeah, I hate it as well. You know, you lose an hour of sleep. And she was like, no, for me, it means that I can't go for a run. And I was like, why not? She said, well, you know, it's not really safe for a woman to go running on her own in the dark. My God. That, and she's just, we're not talking about, we've published stories about, you know, the situation that female runners who live in Afghanistan now face under the new regime, the Taliban regime, you know, that is horrendous, but it's more obvious that there's an inequality there. I'm talking about a woman that I've known, a friend of mine who I've known for years and years and years and years, and, you know, who's a really talented runner, who says to me, oh yeah, you know, don't go running on my own in the dark, it's not safe. And I'm like, this is just wrong. And the answer, and this is, we talk about the magazine being about why we run, not how to run. The answer is not, here's five ways to stay safe when you're out running. I'm not doing that. That's, I'm not publishing that. I want to deal with the social issue that means that women don't feel safe going out for a run when it's dark.
What are the feedback mechanisms for staying in touch with your audience? And are those important? Like, do you see yourself as a trustee in the sense that, like, you can be a tastemaker without needing to get a sense of what people would want from the magazine? Or do you see yourself more as like a delegate where you got to have to like survey your audience and tap into those pre-existing preferences?
Mm. This is something that we wrestle with. I fear that if we, I'm sure it's a misquote, but to use the oft quoted Henry Ford thing, if I'd asked people what they'd wanted, they'd have said faster horses. I fear that if we said to people, what do you want? We would end up with such a wide range of ideas that actually it would be impossible to publish. And we do occasionally have people say, oh, you know, why don't you do product reviews, for example? And I'm like, because there are other people that do amazing product reviews and I can direct you to them. Just go and read their stuff. You know, like, I'm not trying to be all things to all people. So I believe that our tribe exists in more than sufficient numbers to make this thing really successful. And so I think we'll just do our thing, which is what we believe, long form storytelling, talking about social issues, you know, quarterly, et cetera, et cetera. It's a matter of finding the people. Having said that, I really love the idea that we are as accessible and porous as possible. Like, I want people to send me emails. I want people to comment on our social channels. I want as much feedback as possible, because I feel like we're sort of custodians, or we're trying to share the stories, but we want to share people's stories within a sort of framework of what we're trying to achieve as a magazine, which, as I say, is a bit about this sort of trying to explore social issues, trying to talk about history and culture and highlight people that are doing great things within the sport and dig into athlete stories about the person rather than the achievements, all that kind of stuff that we're trying to do. So I want us to have as much engagement as possible with runners. But at the same time, if you ask everyone what they want, you'd end up with an impossible task. I mean,
it sounds like you struck a perfect ideal balance as you scale, where you recognize, okay, I have a platform, so I feel compelled to do certain things that just fulfill social responsibilities, but I'm also going to keep creating content in a way that it was when, like, the first edition came out, where I'm writing to that first person that kind of believed in us, and it's still that, like, one-to-one relationship. Is that kind of how you approach it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this, again, I worry about saying this. I've never said this before on a kind of public forum, but I mean, essentially what Julie and I were trying to do was create the magazine that we wanted to write. And that's a terrible, like, you know, which is, people would say your market research shouldn't be yourself. But then there's a bit of me that thinks, well, why not? You know, I just want to find other people that have the same interests, share the same passion, think about running in the same way. And we're definitely not unique in that. So, yeah, very much not trying to be all things to all people or all things to all runners. We're just trying to kind of serve our tribe, I suppose. Yeah.
I got to come back to a couple background questions, because I'm really interested in the early history of the mag. Mm. What's the best advice you received from that guy who you met for coffee from Row Lure magazine when you were just starting out?
Well, he didn't say this, but his actions were amazing advice.
Say more.
Well, so for anyone that doesn't know, Ruleur is one of the magazines that we looked to when we were kind of coming up with the idea of Light the Wind magazine. I was buying Ruleur magazine, and it's an absolutely beautiful coffee table magazine about the sport of cycling. So it is slightly different from Light the Wind in the sense that they're not writing about mountain biking or urban cycling. They're really focused on the sport of road cycling, the Tour de France, you know, type cycling. But it's absolutely beautiful. And I own a bike, but I'm not a cyclist by a long stretch. But I was buying Ruleur just because I loved it. I mean, I loved the format and the smell and everything else. Anyway, we announced that we were going to publish Light the Wind issue one. And I received an email from this guy called Bruce Sandell, who was the managing director of Ruleur. I think it was called Gruppetto Media, but the company that owned, or the company that published Ruleur. And he said, I see that you're publishing a running magazine. We should meet. Would you like to come to our offices? And Julie and I got the tube. They're in London. We lived in London. So we got the tube over there. And I said, you know what? I've got a bad feeling they're about to publish. We're going for them to tell us that they're publishing a running magazine. and they're going to crush our dreams before we've even got started. And we got in there, and it was like this sort of kind of cathedral to beautiful niche sports publishing. You know, they had, I don't know what they ran, but like 100 issues in at that point, or some crazy number. And they had them all lined up on a shelf, and the offices were beautiful. There was art everywhere. And we sat there feeling like a right pair of Charlies. You know, we hadn't even published issue one at that point. Absolutely, you know, absolute amateurs. And Bruce came in to the meeting, got us a coffee, sat down, and he said, I see what you guys are doing. How can I help? And I was like, wow. We had so many questions. We were like, oh, amazing. Flipped open our, you know, and he, but everything practical stuff, like how do we pick a printer, like you know what font size do we use, all of, it's crazy levels of sort of stuff that we didn't know. So he didn't offer advice. He did actually say one thing, very specific advice. I'll mention that in a second, but it was more his actions of like saying, how can I help? And I have tried, in many cases failed, to live up to that, to try and be generous. And, you know, we've got 10 years of making mistakes. So I try to be generous and be able to say to people, oh, you know, if I can help you, if I can give you advice, then, you know, and I know that I fail many, many, many times, but I do try and live up to that. The only thing, the actual specific advice that Bruce gave us, which was brilliant, was, Be a reader-supported publication. If you can get people to sign up to a direct debit for whatever, I mean, in our case, you know, $45 a year, and you create a good, really good product, there'll be customers for life. And we now have people that have been subscribing to Like the Wind magazine for a decade. And that is amazing. Like, those people are like the most amazing, important people, because they've been there for us every, you know, year after year after year. When the direct debit goes out of their account, they're like, yeah, cool.
Also, thank you to Delta G Ketones for their support of the Single Track Podcast. I've used exogenous ketones in my training and racing over the last 18 months, and these are the best in class. There are many benefits to using ketones in your training, but my favorite is that they improve cognition at exhaustion, which is one of the most important value propositions in an ultra running context. For example, I took a bottle about 2 hours into my race last month at the Red Mountain 50K, and again before the Antelope Island 50 miler last weekend, and just felt a similar level of focus and resolve and overall solid decision-making compared to sort of a pre-race baseline. If you're curious to try them yourself, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order on their site. And with that, let's get back to the conversation with Simon Freeman. Well, it makes me think about, I'll call them misguided worries about competition in the media space, because I have always believed, and you reminded me of it just now, that the primary moat for a media business, or even these like single creator businesses, is your interest, your take on it, and your consistency in putting it out there. And if you follow that formula, you don't have to worry about a thing. And given that, you can be like that guy at Real Lure and just be available to give advice and help new entrants to the extent that they kind of want to follow that formula.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. And, you know, Real Lure has been through, you know, it's not been smooth sailing. They've had, you know, the media landscape has changed. You know, I'm sat here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm in Seattle right now. We've just had a quote to ship a box of magazines to where we are, so that when we go to an event on Monday, we can just give people copies of the magazine. And I just fell off my chair. I'm like, that is an unbelievable amount of money to ship a box of magazines. That's new. That's post pandemic. You know, shipping rates have gone through the roof. So like, there's lots of changes, right? There's lots of things have happened. You know, publishers have had to figure out their response to social media, which on the one hand is an opportunity and an arbitrage, on the other hand is a threat. So Rouleau it's not been smooth sailing for them. Definitely not been smooth sailing for us. But I think that what they've done is they've stuck to their guns. I don't know. I can't speak for them, but I wonder whether at times they thought, oh, you know what? Maybe if we just stuck a few product reviews in, we'd sort of game the algorithm or something. I don't know. You know, but it's bloody tempting. You know, Julie and I have talked about that with regards to like the Wind magazine. You know, you see what other people are doing and you think, oh, maybe if we did that, like, is it too much of a compromise? But if we did that, that might, you know, help us in this regard. But I think creators that are able to stick to, and by the way, what I loved about your kind of comment wrapped in a question then was, it's not just about publishing an ink on paper magazine. We are a creator in exactly the same way that you're producing, you know, a fantastic podcast, a product, storytelling that adds to the culture of running. So I'm not fixed. We just happen to do ink on paper. I mean, audio, video, social media, blogs. Long live the blog. When a blog's going to come back? It's all the same. I think if the core mission is strong enough, then you just figure a way through, right? And when stuff happens that you think, oh, damn it, you just adjust and kind of, you know, regather yourself, remind yourself what you're trying to do and go again.
I've always, because you said earlier that, you know, when you started the magazine, you were creating what you wished sort of already existed, like what you would thoroughly enjoy reading from cover to cover. And maybe this is a radical view, but I very much subscribe to that strategy of producing content. And I've often wondered, in addition to like market forces and issues with attention, I have wondered how many media outlets have experienced a downfall because they abandoned their original interests and their instincts and they started playing someone else's game, or they started to sort of guess about the audience and they just lost their way in that regard. I don't know if you could prove that and draw a very direct line, but like at some core cosmic level, I have always wondered if like the graveyards for a lot of these media companies and attempts were due to that.
I mean, you may be right. I mean, I have opinions about this and very little, if any, data. So I can express my opinion, but it's nothing more than that. You know, I think that I heard a phrase a little while ago, and I can't attribute it. I don't know who said it or whether it's even a real quote, but this idea of like, don't build your house on borrowed land. Like if you know, social media platforms don't exist for any other reason than to make shareholders and owners of those social media platforms rich, in my opinion. So, you know, if your business becomes reliant on, you know, Amazon is another example. You know, it's like at one point, people that were publishing books and selling them on Amazon, it was an amazing outlet for them. But that was just getting publishers addicted to using Amazon. And then Amazon were like, right, now you're all addicted to using Amazon. Now we're going to turn the screws. And suddenly, actually, relying on Amazon is now not such a great idea, because Amazon is not about trying to improve the world of publishing. It's about making money for Amazon. And so, you know, I think there's probably publishers who, you know, chase a trend. And it's not like they don't realize, but perhaps they don't consider that the thing that they're now doing, the arbitrage that they're chasing, is going to close. And when it closes, it sort of makes life difficult to keep going in the same vein. So you've either got to be immensely agile or first or absolutely brilliant. It's difficult. It's really hard.
I love that word arbitrage. And yeah, like a lot of them are very, very small windows of time. And I feel like with a lot of formats out there, not all formats, but a lot of formats and a lot of conversation points, the windows for them are very small, and the opportunity to seize on them, if that's the kind of business or play you wanted to make, you had to start acting on them like 2 years or a year before you saw them actually at the surface being consumed by an audience.
100%. I have a friend who is a podcast expert. He's really knowledgeable. And he started a podcast series called Podcast Graveyard, where he interviews people whose podcasts
I gotta listen.
Dead. Yeah, yeah. Check it out. James Bishop. It's brilliant. Yeah. Podcast Graveyard. And he, I don't want to speak for him, but one of the most fascinating things for me is that when he's talking to these podcasters whose podcasts are now no longer exists, a lot of the time, the reason they no longer exist is because it's around the sort of the commercials or the sort of logistics. And I'm like, but there are people out there who are publishing podcasts that are their passion. They really, really care. And frankly, because they got the why, and the why is this sort of burning thing that they feel compelled to do it, the how and the what will kind of come, will get figured out, and it will be a pain. Like, Julie and I are so passionate about the magazine, and we literally ran into a brick wall after the pandemic, when shipping rates went through the roof. We're still struggling with it. It still kills us. It's unbelievable how much harder it is to ship a box of magazines now. I don't understand, but it's not going to stop us. So now we're like, well, okay, let's come to the US, spend 3 months, meet as many runners as we can, try and raise the profile of the magazine to a point where maybe we can print the magazine in the US and avoid all of the international shipping horror story. You know, you just figure it out. We'll figure it out, because the mission is important to us. So the logistics will just work it out. You know,
one of my personal shortcuts for whether I should do something is, if I couldn't tell anybody about it, if I couldn't share it with the world, would I still pursue it? And like in the case of this conversation with you, even if I couldn't publish this conversation, I would still be having it purely out of self-interest and curiosity and the chance to learn. And I think that also, and again, I feel like I got to get off my high horse, because this, like, you're inspiring me to kind of just like layer on points of view. But that's another thing I feel like I've gotten better at deciphering content that's coming from a genuine place of interest in, like, childlike curiosity versus being derivative, heartlessly chasing a trend and not sustainable. I feel like I can like almost chart exactly how much more shelf life that person's efforts have in the space.
Mm. It's a Simon Sinek concept, isn't it? I mean, it's like, a lot of people understand what they do and a lot of people understand how they do it, but do you understand the why? You know, do you understand the, and if you get the why right, you probably just, It is an absolute cliche, probably, because it's true, but you would just do it anyway. I mean, before Julie and I launched Light the Wind, so going back a bit, so I'm 49 years old. I started running when I was 30. And the reason I started running was that I was like a pack-a-day smoker. I was massively overweight. I drank like a fish, ate terribly, did no exercise, and thought, I need to do something to sort of fix my life. So running was cheap and easy, and I had a crappy old pair of sneakers that I could use, so I could just start immediately. And it's a longer story, but essentially I did it enough that I thought, actually, this is brilliant, I love this. So I got bitten by the bug, and so we're talking, you know, nearly 20 years ago, I started a blog, Long Live Blogs. And
they're,
I would
just,
back. They're coming back, bring back the blog. And so I would sit and write, and if you ask Julie, when we meet you in a few weeks,
please,
she would say that I had a job then. I worked for somebody else. And so I would do my day job, come home in the evening, we'd have dinner. And then rather than sitting in front of the telly or whatever, I would write a blog post about running, because I was absolutely fascinated by it. I just loved it. I loved every aspect of it. It was all knowledge and learning and what have you. And Julie said, give Simon credit where credit's due. He would sit and write this blog. No one was reading it. or if they were, I had no idea. I'm not a very technically minded person. I had no idea. Like, there was no traffic. I wasn't chasing traffic or numbers. I just wanted to get this stuff out there. I just wanted to write it down. And even if 10 people read it, I was like, oh, that's all right. That's fine. It's just, I care about it. And in actual fact, that sort of stupid little blog has led to a lot of the opportunities that we've now got, because it did grow, but not way more through luck than judgment. You know, there was no plan. I was just excited about this opportunity to, you know, share with the world what I was learning as I was getting into running, you know. So that's exactly what you were saying, you know.
Totally.
You publish this thing and don't worry about whether it's got an audience, or maybe you don't even publish it. I don't know. But you're doing it for its own sake.
By the way, on the blog front, because I have an SEO background, we can talk about your digital marketing agency in a second, but I have an SEO background, and I'll still kind of plug away on Search Console and analytics and Ahrefs. And I'm amazed constantly at how many businesses out there that are primarily content-based and have an active blog, how much search traffic they're getting, and then how much is converting onto all of their like key product and service page. It's amazing. So I know that there's probably some good data out there that says, you know, long form written blog based content is not where it was, whatever, 5, 10, 15 years ago. But I'm still seeing incredible stuff. I actually posted something about iRunFar because, you know, they got purchased maybe 2 or 3 years ago by Lola. Yep. And mm-hmm. Lola kind of converted that website into this awesome affiliate play, and their search traffic just went gangbusters. There's still amazing opportunity out there. It's incredible. That and YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know the there's a podcast called People versus Algorithms?
Oh my gosh, you're giving me such good. I'm gonna have to ask you for People versus Algorithms.
So People versus Algorithms it's normally three guys talking about media, but they're talking about it in the broadest sense. So they're talking about the New York Times and Meta and, you know, Google and things like that. But I find it, you know, fascinating. And they're quite they kind of give each other a lot of, they throw shade at each other. It's quite funny. And they're very dry and sort of cynical about these sorts of things. But in a recent episode, you know, they were talking about SEO and the fact that obviously we went through a period where, again, going back to this idea of building your house on borrowed land, there was a period where lots and lots of businesses became addicted to social media channels for reaching their audience. And the social media channels were like, well, what we want is 150 words and a big headline. And so a lot of businesses, and I include publishers in that, were like, okay, well, if that's what it needs, that's what we'll give it. Now that's changed or is changing. And suddenly, because AI, anyone with a keyboard and AI can produce 150 words and a big headline, suddenly it's not special. So you're just one, there's just this massive kind of, you know, volume of sort of that sort of noise. And quietly over there is this entity that's just been continuing to write on their blog post and probably for several years was thinking, this is so dumb. This is such a stupid idea. All of a sudden, Google's search is not going away. Search is not going away. And a well-crafted long-form blog post is either fantastic entertainment for somebody that doesn't want to scroll through social media endlessly, or contains brilliant information, and it's just surfacing, it's coming up. And if you've been doing it for 5 or 8 or 10 or 12 or 20 years, you know, you've got depth, which is, it's like podcast episodes or YouTube videos, I mean YouTube channels.
I wrote down, so I got Podcast Graveyard, I've got People versus Algorithms. These are great. You've given me two. I got to give you one. You might already know him, but do you know Ben Demon? Is that name?
No.
He's this American expat based in the Pyrenees. He's got an amazing Substack. I think he would be an incredible contributor to The Wind. I've never seen somebody write so romantically about the rigors of being an elite athlete and trying to get to the top of the sport. We've had him on the pod before. He's amazing. I'll send you a link after, but as we're on this sort of blogosphere topic, he came to mind. Talking about Freestack for a second, what skills and experiences did you pick up there that you ported over to like The Wind?
Now the irony is that we should be much better at marketing like The Wind, having run a business that was essentially assisting running cycling and outdoors brands to improve their marketing efforts. So what Freestack became was essentially a platform that connected running, cycling and outdoors brands with content creators in a way that allowed both parties to sort of understand the rules of engagement and analyze how well the partnership was going.
That's really cool.
It was a really good idea. I mean, I think the company that acquired it are going to blow it up because they're bigger and they've got the ability to sort of stretch it beyond the sort of narrow niche that Julie and I worked in. Although I'm a big niche fan, so I sort of think there are other influencer or content creator platforms out there that were agnostic. And I think that where we benefited was that we were sort of, we had an expertise or a perceived expertise in a particular sector. I'm not really sure what we managed to learn from Freestack that has much of an impact on what we're doing with Like the Wind. I mean, the exciting thing for me about Like the Wind is I've never worked in a consumer business. I've only ever worked in business to business companies, worked in agencies, worked in communications and marketing agencies my whole life. Suddenly what I'm trying to do is sell Finn a £40 subscription to a magazine and have him then, you know, keep subscribing. That's a whole new world of trying to understand what it is that you need to do to kind of cut through the noise and get to the point where Finn's like, oh yeah, this that looks interesting. I'll put my credit card in and subscribe or buy an issue to see what it's like. So I mean, I suppose we were exposed to a lot of marketeers at brands, sports and outdoors brands that were trying to do that job. So probably something rubbed off. Certainly what you said something earlier, which I thought was brilliant, you know, that the number of times that somebody needs to come across your message, be exposed to your brand, yeah, is higher than I like to admit. And as somebody that doesn't like to nag or you know what it, like we send, we have a newsletter that we send every 2 weeks. And sometimes in the back of my mind, I think maybe we should be sending an email out daily. But then personally, if I sign up to somebody's newsletter and they start emailing me daily, I kind of unsubscribe pretty quickly because I'm like, it's too much. So you see, we're kind of learning by doing, but we obviously through Freestack had lots and lots and lots of opportunities to see how brands were trying to, you know, raise awareness of their brand and product. And so I guess we probably have absorbed some of that along the way.
I identify with that gap though too, because like prior to going into single track full time, I was a marketer for about 10 years, and almost none of the channels that I gained expertise in those 10 years have I attempted to leverage with single track. Like I'm still an offender in the sense that I don't have a digital address. Like I have a website, but it's shameful compared to like client websites that I used to work on in the past, or even just like the company websites that I was building up. So that's something that I've learned, is that like the enthusiasm that I had in a prior career doesn't necessarily neatly port over to the brand building that I should and could do in real time.
Well, I'm probably going to sound like I'm making an excuse for myself, but I'll offer it to you in case you want to adopt it. One of my favorite books, and I'm sure many, many people will, you know, go, oh, really? But Shoe Dog is an amazing book. So good, right? My favorite bit of Shoe Dog is the absolute mess that Nike was at the beginning, you know, and now you look at, right, and now you look at it as this sort of, you know, $40-50 billion a year global entity, and you know, and think, wow, incredible. But it is worth remembering that Phil Knight was driving around in a clapped out old, you know, car, selling shoes out of the back of the car. So sometimes, this is me making an excuse, but sometimes I think, oh God, we should be doing all these things that all these other businesses are doing or were doing, and forget that those businesses that we worked with are what far more established than we are, and we're just doing what they were doing at the start of their business. You know, it's okay. It's okay. Because it's back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, if you're clear on the mission, you know what you're trying to do, just keep doing that. And thinking, oh, you know, we should be running, you know, this sort of enormous global social media campaign with money we don't have is just a distraction. It's just a distraction. Can't.
So much of, I would say 70% of what we do, I would characterize as incoherent. And about 30% of what we do is coherent. And maybe the audience interacts with most of that 30%, but they also see the 10% of the 70%. And that's what I lose sleep over.
Yeah. I mean, and it's fun. It's great fun, isn't it? It's like, you know, not knowing is actually part of the fun. It's like if I could do some sort of matrix thing where I kind of plugged into the back of your head all the answers to how this thing would be successful, you would be bored quickly. Like it is the process that is the exciting thing, right? It's like if I said to you, I literally can clip my fingers and you'll know exactly how to make Single Track the most successful podcast on the planet overnight, you'd do it because that would be great. But I suspect that within a very short period of time, I'd say to you, how's it going? You'd be like, yeah, I'm kind of on to the next thing. I've decided that I'm going to do something else or something additional, because really the challenge is not in the finish line. It's the kind of the getting to the finish line, which we don't ever get to. So that's all part of the fun, right?
I'm going to have to reflect on that Nike example more. That's good.
Yeah, just keep, every time you think, oh God, what am I doing? Just read the first couple of chapters of Shoe Dog and you'll feel way better about yourself.
He also had that, one of those early employees, I think his last name was like Johnson or something, who opened up the entire West Coast market and then was like so faithful that he went and opened up the East Coast. Like, need one of those too.
Yeah, well, I mean, 100%. I mean, and again, Bruce Sandell, I mean, back to Bruce Sandell, he owed us absolutely nothing and was just like, how can I help you? We're doing on this tour that we're embarking upon. I mean, many of the events that we're doing over the next 3 months, people have just said, oh my God, this sounds amazing. Can I host an event for you? I'm like, really? I keep coming up with this same question, which is, okay, but is there something in this for you? Like, what's the value for you? Because I'm worried that I can see the value for me. It's amazing. There's people that are saying, look, I've got a local run club. I'll organize the whole thing. You just turn up at this date and this location and we'll introduce you to this community. Oh, this is amazing. But is there anything in this for you, sort of thing? That's important. People are amazing. You having me on this podcast is amazing. I'm so grateful. You know, it's such a fantastic opportunity.
This would probably require just a subjective, you know, opinion from you, but I'm hearing a lot of people say that just given the media landscape, there's a huge opportunity, maybe even a necessity, if you want to be relevant, to go super premium, kind of in the direction that Like the Wind has gone, right? Like, I would characterize Like the Wind as a super premium media brand in the running space. Do you think that that's always the case? And will there always be sort of this limitless opportunity for somebody to go super niche in a category, or will we hit a point like right now, but in the opposite direction, where people need to go more like mainstream because it's so convoluted in the other way?
I mean, I think there'll always be. So I mentioned, you know, I started running when I was 30, Runner's World subscriber. Like I needed info. I needed information. And a lot of the people that I met when I started running don't run now. Like they got into it, they loved it for a while, other things came along in their lives, they don't run now. You know, 20 years later, I'm still desperately chasing marathon times and trying to get back in, always trying to get back in shape, and always trying to figure out, you know, if and when I'm ever going to do the 100 miler that I have convinced myself I want to do. But so I think that there will always be people who are seeking information and knowledge. And information and knowledge is easily packageable, easily kind of deliverable in bite size. What I'm hoping is that there are also always going to be people for whom the thing, whatever it is, cars, watches, cigars, movies, skateboarding, whatever, is like lifestyle. And for them, they will always want to just consume all the media. They'll watch all the movies. They'll sit and, you know, refresh the feed from the Barclays marathons for 60 hours, you know, and just get so insanely excited about whether Jasmine Paris is going to make it back. You know, that is, so I think there'll always be those people as well. You know, I'm not a car guy. I would never consume media about cars. I needed to buy a car. So at one point I was like, oh, I went online and just Googled a bit and just tried to understand a little bit about cars and what do I need to know? As soon as I got the information that I needed in order to purchase a car, that's it. I don't turn up at car shows. I'm not interested. I'm not watching videos I'm not consuming media about it. So I think that the informational side will always exist. And I think there'll always be an audience. There'll always be people who will think, oh, you know what? I need to get in shape. I love the idea of doing a marathon. I've heard a lot about this trail running. I saw this thing about this woman who completed this 60-hour race with 99 seconds to spare that managed to appear on the national news. And that's fascinating to me. I'd love to figure out a bit about that. That will always happen. And that's brilliant. That's, you know, your sort of entry level, and media needs to cater to that. Then I think that there will be a longer tail of people that just then get stuck in it. And for them, it just becomes their everything. And for them, a different type of media is more appropriate and more satisfying. You know, they're the ones that are going to download and listen to an hour and a half episode podcast. Because it's a lifestyle.
I'm laughing because I feel like I contradicted myself. I was just on my high horse earlier saying, trust your intuition, create from the heart. And then I totally forgot that and asked you a question about being opportunistic in the space. So to the audience, I always contradict myself and I apologize.
No, but you know what? I think that contradiction is essential, actually, in any conversation around media, probably in business, but I don't know because I'm only in this one. It's very romantic to suggest that actually you just follow your art and you create for the sake of creation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and then you become Van Gogh and die in poverty. You know, that doesn't work if actually you want to pay the mortgage and you're trying to, you know, raise a family and you've got overheads and expenses. So there is a contradiction. It does that contradiction exists. I think it's threading the needle. Right? It's how do you? For me, it's about how do we do the thing that is true to what we're passionate about. That's what keeps you going through the hard times. But at the same time, being cognizant and aware of the fact that there's got to be a commercial, you know, there's got to be a commercial reality, unless you win the lottery. I mean, I was listening to the radio in an Uber yesterday and they announced that the I don't know if it's the state or the national lottery in the US is $1 billion. Okay, if you win that, do what you like. Don't worry about the money. Then it becomes completely irrelevant. But, you know, otherwise, I think you do have to keep one eye on it, on the commercial realities.
This is more coming back to like the win, but at the current moment, are you more interested in improving as an editor or as a publisher, and why?
That is a really good question. So because the team is so small, it's me, Julie, Imogen is the deputy editor. Alex is the designer who works with Julie, who's the creative director. We now have a new US editor, a lady called Amory. Then we've got one colleague in Japan and Laura, who helps on project management. But I mean, that's essentially the team. We all wear quite a few hats and I love being the editor. I love it. But I actually don't think it's where my skill set lies. And I'm probably, you know, being the publisher, you know, having a kind of view on the kind of commercials, but having responsibility for the commercial side of the business is probably where I have more skills and more experience. And so I think, unfortunately, probably what I need to do is do less of the thing I love and more of the thing that I'm good at for the sake of the business, you know, because of that commercial. The editing thing, you know, when we launched the magazine, I just literally started buying books called How to Edit a Magazine, you know, The Idiot's Guide to Editing a Magazine. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. Pretty much still don't. So, yeah, I think if we want the magazine, the business to grow, yeah, I probably need to do more, become a better publisher, truthfully.
It doesn't necessarily have to be in the running space, but who are some other media operators that you are enjoying following and learning from at this stage?
I think what Dylan Bowman is doing at Free Trial is absolutely brilliant. He's doing a fantastic job. And I don't know, I hope he won't mind me saying this, but I mean, I know that he has struggled with being an entrepreneur and a media, the owner of a media business, and also being an elite athlete and figuring out, you know, threading the needle. I'm fortunate in that I'm so far from being an elite athlete that I don't need to worry about it. But, you know, I know that I think he's doing a brilliant job over there. I really marvel at that. My good friend Mario Frioli, the Morning Shakeup podcast, his sort of not only grit and determination, but also his flexibility around what he does, I think is really admirable. And I absolutely love all of his content. I think there's some magazines that I just absolutely love. There's a magazine called Adventure Magazine, which is, it's basically about, you know, van life. That's a relatively new magazine, and that is what an absolute favorite of mine. There's a magazine called Sidetracked that's published by a guy called John Summerton. John launched Sidetracked about 6 months after we launched Light the Wind, and his magazine is absolutely beautiful. I mean, it arrives, you know, in my inbox, in my mailbox, and every time I open it, I'm just like, you know, blown away. There's a US magazine called Mountain Gazette, a guy called Mike Rogge, who has resurrected a magazine. So he's working on issue 201. But I think that the first sort of 180 issues were published by the previous owner. And on a much more frequent basis, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think it was monthly for decades. And then Mike bought the magazine, and now I think he's producing two a year. But it's absolutely stunning. And what he's doing around community building is you know, really fantastic, really marvelous. There's a few.
Yeah, going back to Debo, he's actually got, I don't know if you might know this, but he has a new media venture out too called Second Nature, yeah, which is really cool. And it sort of follows, it kind of keeps a beat on outdoor industry business, which I think I'm really excited about. I mean, I've followed Free Trail for a long time, but I mean, this one is even more of interest to me.
So the first episode came out, and I listened to it immediately that it was published, and then sent him a message saying, okay, when's the next one? Which I know is super annoying, because he's probably like, geez, you know, calm down, dear. But I love that. Trail Mix, Matt Walsh. And again, you know, maybe an underappreciated media type. But a good old newsletter. Matt Walsh's Trail Mix is fantastic. Again, looking at the business side of trail running, you know, Matt is a real artisan when it comes to kind of, you know, thinking through all the sort of different aspects of trail running, the trail running business. Every time it pops into my inbox, I star it, and then I kind of almost save it as a like, right, I'm gonna take 15, 20 minutes or whatever to read that. And very often, I'm sure I annoy the hell out of him, but I will very often respond. So I hit return and just quickly write down 10, 5 things that I thought about reading his newsletter. he's very generous. He says that he doesn't mind. I'm sure I just get on his nerves, but yeah, that's another one.
Similar. I do the same thing. I starve for later and I kind of make a cup of coffee and I sit down and I process. It's excellent.
Yeah.
I haven't asked you too much just about, I mean, we started the episode with running culture, but I haven't asked you much about running culture or sort of the history of the sport. I understand that you are an avid fan of the marathon distance and you especially love the Dick Beardsley, Alberto Salazar era. Why? Talk about that interest and in why that particular era of the sport.
You know, I think that, so my, as I mentioned, my personal background was I took up running as a kind of, you know, I lived in central London. Trail running did not feature for at all. In fact, you know, I was sort of aware of it as this sort of fringe thing. But for me, running was going out my front door and pounding the streets in central London. The London Marathon was sort of thing that I was aware of. I could visualize. I had a good friend who had gone on a similar journey, given up all the vices and started running, and a bit before me. So I kind of followed in his footsteps, and I just got, I think it's probably a character trait, but I just got really obsessed with this idea of the control required to run a good marathon. You know, you want to start at the pace that you intend to finish the race. There's no point starting too fast because it ain't going to go well at around about mile 20. And there's no point starting too slow because by the time you figure out that you feel great, you haven't got time to kind of make a dent. So you've got to almost, I love that idea of, well, I'm trying to hit this time. Kind of got to start at that minute per mile for the whole thing. So that appealed to some part of my nature. And then I think if you take any sport, there are eras when there are just titans, like people that are just, and I don't know whether it's coincidence or whether they feed off of one another. From a marathoning, you know, perspective, everything seemed to come together in that period of the sort of, you know, 70s, mid-70s through to the sort of early 80s. And, you know, Salazar, Beardsley, in the US, you know, those guys were just, they were raising the bar. They just continued to sort of make racing more exciting. You know, my hero worship of those guys reached a zenith about two, maybe it was a year and a half after we launched Like the Wind magazine. We were given the opportunity to be at the London Marathon Expo one year. And I'd been sending some emails backwards and forwards with Dick Beardsley because I emailed his foundation, like info at the Dick Beardsley Foundation, to say, you're my all-time favorite athlete. Will you write a story for issue one of Like the Wind? And he did. And it's an amazing story. I could talk about this for forever. But so then I was sort of backwards and forwardsing with him occasionally. And then I mentioned to him that we were going to be on the stand at the London Marathon. And in the middle of the day, I looked down the aisle and there was Dick Beardsley and Inge Simonsen, who are the two guys that won the first London Marathon hand in hand, joint first, walking up towards me, both wearing matching red T-shirts. And I was, you know, supposedly an adult, a grown human being, you know, and I was like a little kid meeting a Disney princess. I was like, I was just beside myself. So I've got a photo of me with my arms around Dick Beardsley and Inge Simonsen. I mean, I just think that but it's the same in anything, right? In boxing, tennis, golf. I don't know. There are eras when people are just elevating it and just making it so exciting. I would have loved to have been around and, you know, been interested in the sport at the time to have sort of witnessed what they were doing.
One last quick break to thank Rabbit, the official apparel partner of the Single Track Podcast. Rabbit has a few new arrivals on their website worth checking out, including new colorways for their High Country short sleeve t-shirt, their Shredder shorts, and one of my personal favorites, their Deflector sun shirts. Go check it all out at runinrabbit.com and feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to the conversation with Simon Freeman. Have you read the book Duel in the Sun?
Yeah.
So my friend Rich, he won't mind me saying this, he sent me a text the other day because we were kind of talking about why, we were speculating on why marathoners of that era were able to train harder and race more frequently and still put up fairly elite results, like in like the late 70s, early 80s. And he sent me, I got to read this to you because the audience might find this interesting. Deirdre thinks that the baby boom generation of American distance runners excelled because they approached the sport with single-minded, starving artist-like devotion. Quote, "We didn't have a whole lot going on in our lives besides running," he points out. "No cell phones or email, no PhD programs, no flights to Aruba for spring break." He also cites the fact that serious distance runners of the era banded together in tightly knit communities in which peer pressure and intramural competition led to continuous improvement. There's a lot more to it, but I think that's so interesting that like one of the theories is that there was less sort of mental stuff competing for the athlete's mental attention to have that much success. Like, whereas now we're bombarded with social media and attention fatigue. It's crazy.
I couldn't agree more. And I may be about to say something stupid. In fact, I regularly say stupid things, but I had the opportunity to go to Iten in Kenya in the Rift Valley last year. And there's not much going on in Iten. You know, the people are not, I mean, people are not really distracted by social media. They're not, they're not going out to nightclubs. I mean, people, they're not going to restaurants. I mean, there's a lot of the athletes that I met are living on very, very, very little money, which as a side note, I think is what drives the level of excellence coming out of that area of East Africa, because the opportunities are available to athletes who start winning or placing highly in you know, big city marathons is they're life-changing amounts of money in that area. And I was only there for a week, but in that week I fell into this rhythm of, yeah, you're not distracted. Like, it's a very almost like monastic, very simple, you know, you get up super early, it gets hot during the day, so everyone's up really early, you drink a coffee, you go up the road and there's huge groups of runners, you do your run, you come back. It's a, yeah, really simple. There's not a lot going on. So I was staying in a hotel, you know, supposedly with Wi-Fi. It was a bit patchy, but I could get online. But I remember, so the other thing is that by 8 o'clock, having had dinner, I was in my room in this hotel, which is the poshest hotel, which is a relative term, the poshest hotel in Iten. And I thought, oh, I'll watch something on Netflix. There was no way that I was going to get on Netflix. There was Wi-Fi, but it was just about enough that I could send my wife a WhatsApp message. You know, it was really not good. And it was a bit patchy. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I'm not watching Netflix. I had a book with me. I do love reading books. I'm really into American political history. So I had a really good book. I thought to myself, oh, I tell you what, rather than laying here in bed, on my bed, I'll go back down into the bar and I'll sit and read my book in the bar. I went back to the bar. It's closed. There's nothing. They're just, everyone's gone home. So I went back to the room, you know, and I was like, this is, yeah, you understand. There's not a lot of distractions. There's not a lot of other things to do. People are, you know, their main thing is running and the competition as well. I mean, to the quote that you, the thing that you read, the competition is incredible. Like, these athletes are absolutely taking chunks out of themselves. Like, they have these things called, I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but they have these bike taxis, motorbike taxis called Boda Boda. And it's, you're talking about, like, you know, if you get on a Boda Boda and go, you know, 30 minutes, it's a couple of dollars. Like, it's really cheap. Anyway, so I got to know one of the Boda Boda drivers that would always sit at the top of the road that was the road from the hotel up to the main drag. So I just happened to, this guy took me wherever I needed to go a couple of times. So then, you know, I got to know him a little bit. And I said to him, look, I really want to go and follow one of the runs with the elite athletes. And I've got, there's absolutely no way that I can follow them on foot as a runner. Hey, no problem. He says, jump on the back. And we went off and followed this group. It was probably about 200 people in this group. And they start off and it's all kind of, oh yeah, I know the deal. They start off slowly and they're, you know, running along and we're just bobbling along on the bike next to him. And then then it really kicked up. It really, the pace really changed. And I was aware of the fact that these athletes are really taking chunks out of each other. Like they're taking no prisoners. The level of competition, I was like, oh, wow. Okay. You know, they're taking it deadly seriously. It was amazing.
I almost don't want that Wi-Fi signal to get stronger in E10. Like I understand there's massive economic benefits to it getting stronger and creating more generalized opportunity outside of running, but there is a tragic element to it that like if it gets stronger, there will inevitably be an end to that type of lifestyle where you can have this kind of romantic monomaniacal focus on an activity. You're probably like brain is in a better state because it's not, you know, getting sort of attention hacked all the time.
I'm
probably romanticizing because I have not been there, but it seems awesome.
Okay. So this is a really interesting point. So the reason I had the opportunity to go to ITEN was actually because I was invited to go on a media trip to Kaptagat, which is down the road, which is where the NN running team, which is the team that Eliud Kipchoge, Faith Kipyegon, Jeffrey Kamworor, and a whole load of other athletes are part of, right? So the NN team invite a small number, I think it was 5 journalists out for each year for like a 3-day period, which I couldn't turn down that opportunity. So I went out, and then rather than just leaving after that 3 days and flying home, I said, well, I'm now going to take myself off to ITEN for, you know, 10 days. But the Kaptagat thing, you're talking about athletes like Eliud Kipchoge, Faith Kipyegon, Jeffrey Kamworor. These people are enormously successful, and they would be, you know, their earnings and winnings are significant in global terms, not just in East African terms. So they've got beautiful houses, beautiful cars. You know, they have all of the financial resources to live an amazing life by anyone's standards, right? And yet they choose to live in this compound where, you know, I remember at one point we went in and it was a handwritten sheet of paper on the wall. And it was all of the things, all of the chores. And it's got like toilet cleaning, Thursday, Eliud. Like, I mean, crazy. Eliud Kipchoge is cleaning the toilets on Thursday. They're all cycling. All of these athletes are all going through the you know, they're living this amazingly ascetic life. Like I had brought copies of Like the Wind magazine. They were like, oh, brilliant. You can put them in the library. And they've got a room which has got rows with about 18 plastic garden chairs inside in this room, a television that looked like it was, you know, from the 80s, and a bookshelf. And they were like, oh, you can put the magazines on the bookshelf. And there's just really, really well thumbed, probably a copy of Jewel in the Sun, you know, really well thumbed books on this bookshelf. They are living a really, really ascetic lifestyle. Their husbands, wives, kids, and this, you know, all of the trappings of significant success on a global sense are 2 kilometers up the road. They go home on Sunday. So they're in camp from up till Saturday night, Sunday morning, then they go home for the day. And then Monday, they're back in camp in really, really basic accommodation. They took us around and they were like, oh, yeah, so this is, they've got a water tower. And they said, yeah, it was only like 2 years ago. So I was there in June last year. So it was only 2 years ago that we had a well to get clean water. And then after that, we got solar panels so that we can have, so the water can be warm. I was like, what? Now, 15 minutes drive up the road is home, which is, these, you know, a beautiful house with all of the trappings and, you know, all the Wi-Fi and, you know, LCD televisions. And they choose to put themselves in this environment. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it seems like there's been a lot of moments in history where there's been these inflection points for lifestyle. And there have been people, if given the opportunity, they would choose the simpler, more natural existence. Like one of the things that I learned, at least in like high school history, in an otherwise brutal area, colonialism, a lot of the settlers that came over to, you know, North America in the 1600s, when they were choosing between sort of like the Puritan lifestyle and the Native American lifestyle, there was a lot, the Puritans had a lot of trouble retaining their population. They would move. They would want to live with the natives. They were so stoked on that lifestyle. They were like, I want to go do that.
Yeah.
Just reminding me. I know that's kind of random, but just it's cool. It's I think it's a good lesson, like the simplicity.
But it feels as though we've kind of come back to the why again, doesn't it? It's like, I mean, I interviewed Xavier Tevenard a little while ago, and you know, he lives relatively close to where I live in Switzerland. You know, in a really, really small, you know, rural village in a very basic, you know, setup. And his passion is being in nature, trail running, cross-country skiing. And so he's clearly choosing to put himself in a situation. I don't know what his financial situation is, but he doesn't appear to have any interest in, you know, getting a fancy job and taking an apartment in Geneva or Lausanne. He's like, oh no, this is where I need to be. This is where I want to be, because his why is so powerful. It's all about being in nature and the work that he's trying to do around sustainability. And so I guess he could choose to be elsewhere, but he's sort of making lifestyle choice. And or Zach Miller. Didn't Zach Miller, wasn't he? He was a hut guardian, lived up a mountain, you know, made that choice. Or David Laney, lived in his car for years.
Yeah.
Is there a connection? Is there any wonder that these people are so good at what they do from an athletics point of view, when they're making choices to remove the comfort and the distractions that, you know, feel good? I wonder.
I was talking to this guy at Barclay, Whit Wisebrim, who I hope to have on the podcast at some point, but he was saying that he's not convinced that the best sponsorship model is the current model of brand athlete. It's actually making just enough money to live out of your car and park at a trailhead. And if you can just get comfortable with like a bed set up in the back of your car and cooking out of a jet boil or some other sort of mini stove contraption, and you can escape all the responsibilities of needing to be on social 24/7 on behalf of that brand and reporting back on gear. If you actually like take out that opportunity cost, that might be the best model, and which it's hard to disagree with.
Yeah. But then this could go off on a tangent. You know, I think a lot of people associate they associate their financial situation, the amount of money that they earn, with how they're valued and their success. So, you know, receiving more money is an acknowledgement of all the hard work that you've put in and all the success that you've had. So one of the things that I thought was brilliant about the athletes that I met in the NN camp in Kaptagat was they choose to live in this situation because they know that that's the best place and situation for them to become the best athletes that they can be. But this, in the back of their mind, they know the trappings of their success and all the hard work is 20 minutes up the road. Whereas in Iten, I met a lot of athletes who are working incredibly hard and have no trappings. They haven't managed to. They're not choosing to live in a one-room tin shack with no electricity, because that's how they're going to become the best athletes they can be. That's the situation they're in, because they haven't earned. You know, they aren't able to sort of earn the money that would give them the kind of the comfort and the trappings. So, if you can choose to live in your back car. Live in your car and cook all your food on a jet boil, but you know that somehow in the background there's a sort of comfort safety net. I don't know the answer.
Simon, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and we probably got to do a round two, because I'm looking at like 20 questions in my notes app right now.
When you only get 11 downloads of this episode, you'll change your mind.
I think it'll be a lot more than that. But I also think, like I said, going back to what we were saying earlier, just about the initiative behind all this stuff, like I create for myself. That's been the formula since day one. Like I would be lying if I said that there weren't moments, even relatively recently, where I felt pushed to do something, or I felt like I had to do something out of obligation. But I would say, because I'm human, but like 97% of the time, the content comes from the soul, I would say.
And, you know, I'm not saying this because I'm, you know, on the podcast, because it, and it is an honor, but honestly, I think that that comes across in the content that you produce and the way that you obviously clearly research your guests, and the way that you obviously have such a great rapport with them. I mean, I think if you were doing this for the clicks or for the ad revenue, it wouldn't have this sort of sense of, it's a horrible overused word, but it wouldn't have this sense of authenticity that clearly everything that you do has. So that's why I was so stoked to have the opportunity to be a guest.
Yeah, we have.
I'm in pretty rare company, so thanks.
It's much appreciated. We had a guest recently who said, you know, I donated to you on Patreon because I know you're not a millionaire. And I said, listen, I'm not even a thousandaire. Okay, let's not get ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think if you can keep doing what you're doing, which is of so much value to the running community, and if the millionaire status comes, great. And if it doesn't, great. Then
still worth
that's,
it.
Yeah, that's the perfect position to be in.
We'll make sure to link to everything Like the Wind related in the show notes. It has truly been an honor to have you on the podcast, Simon. Do you have any final thoughts or calls to action that you want to leave listeners and viewers with before we go?
No. In all honesty, I think anyone that's discovering this podcast for the first time, I just would say everything that you've done has been brilliant. I'm an avid fan. I don't have enough time to listen to dozens and dozens and dozens of podcasts. You are one of the few that I'm subscribed to. So I would say anyone that's got to this point, if they've managed to listen to my ramblings for however long we've been talking, and they're discovering your podcast for the first time, I would just say you're definitely, in my view, contributing to running culture. And so I would say to people, go back and listen to some of the episodes that are much more coherent. Much more interesting. It can only get better from here on out. So, yeah, just thanks for what you're doing.